Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
I am Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Gene Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Hey, Gene, we've got a really cool episode, don't we?
Yes, indeed. The Mighty Oak.
The Mighty Oak, yeah. We're doing a round table. The whole team is going to talk about oaks. And who doesn't want to talk about oaks? Oaks are like the most amazing tree. It's probably the most important tree for wildlife that you can plant or have on your property. Don't ever cut one down. They support really hundreds of different caterpillars that then in turn support the birds. So very, very cool.
And the caterpillars eat the trees and the birds eat the caterpillars. And I'm getting hungry for some melon. Annie joins us with patch to plate and starts talking about melons, which are probably coming due right about now. She starts with watermelons.
I'm impressed that you could segue from caterpillars eating oaks to us eating melons. But I agree. Yeah, melons are the best.
Subtlety. It's my forte. And then we talk about cantaloupes and honeydews, and I never probably paid attention enough to know that they're like totally different colors, and I should know the difference, but I never did.
And they have very distinctive tastes, especially if you're a melon connoisseur, but I love all melons.
And Annie can grill them. I never thought of that.
You're making me hungry again, Jane.
Let's go grab some melon and listen to some stories.
Terrific.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. Today, we're having another one of our patented roundtables. The subject is so big, we need the whole team. I'm Jean.
I'm Tim.
I'm Teresa.
I'm Annie.
I'm Linda.
Okay, what are we talking about today? Oaks. Yes, that's a big subject. We've all heard of the mighty oak. I think we all have our own very personal take on oak trees. I have an oak tree that was about 300 years old, and for 3 years I watched a hawk family raise their babies and watched the babies take their practice flying lessons. You haven't lived till you've seen a baby hawk fly. Well, it's more the landings that are the entertaining part.
I have an oak story, too. I had the great fortune of growing up next to my grandmother. When my folks got married, she split her lot, and they built the house that I grew up on that second half of the lot. And between our homes was a gigantic double oak that all of us kids lived in.
When I think of oaks, I always think of firewood. My husband and I have a wood stove that we use, and my husband is always looking for oak trees when they fall to cut up a firewood. But we recently were on a trip to Australia, and I saw an oak garden where they actually took the fallen oak tree and planted all around it, created benches from the trunk, and it was beautiful.
Nice.
So my oak story is right after 9/11, we obviously have a really devastating time, and we were living in the city, and we had our house in Columbia County, and we came up for refuge and stayed at the house, and I went into my garden for refuge, and I was at the nursery, and they had oaks. So I bought two oaks and planted them in memory of the people who died in the Twin Towers. And they are beautiful, tall, mature, wonderful trees. And I think of it every time I see them.
That's a really nice story, Tim.
Poor Linda can't tell us any oak stories.
She has persimmon stories and almond stories and mango stories. Come on, Linda, tell us a non-oak story.
Well, when we were in Bangkok, there was a mango tree right next to the house. And I would crawl out of the second floor bedroom window and pull mangoes off the tree and have them very fresh.
Wow. So she was ornery then, too.
I can actually visualize
yeah,
that.
Yeah, totally.
Linda, by the way, is an army brat, so she just missed the opportunity to grow up with oaks like the rest of us. Mm-hmm.
So oaks belong to the botanical family Fagaceae, which includes the three main groups of beech, oak, and chestnut. There are flowering trees, and most produce nuts. Oak flowers are unique. The trees bear both male and female flowers, and the catkin formation is very common in the early spring, often used for foraging bees. Even though they are wind-pollinated, foraging bees use them.
Well, in regard to the oaks, here's some numbers. There are 300 species of oaks worldwide, 55 of which are native to North America, most in the eastern U.S., 16 of native to New York State, and they're the largest group of native forest trees in the state.
Wow. But an oak is an oak, right? Wrong. Oaks are valuable in a lot of ways. They're valuable as lumber and firewood, as ornamentals, providing shade for people. But for those who are concerned about things like pollination and preservation of the species in a world threatened by global warming, they are superheroes.
Doug Tallamy, ecologist who popularized the Keystone Species philosophy, records that a single oak can harbor over 900 species of insects, birds, and animals. The stage of their life cycle that involves the oak host is vital to their survival.
Let's look at the even bigger picture. Forests are the lungs of the planet, and oaks are a significant portion of many of these forests. A forest develops over years, going from bare soil, whether open fields or undeveloped areas. The first stages are composed of pioneer species like annuals, forbs, and small shrubs. Then comes the intermediate stage of small trees and understory plants. And finally, the climax species are grown enough to dominate. And these, of course, include the mighty oak. The entire succession can take a century or more, and an individual oak can live for several hundred years.
Bear in mind that humans can accelerate the process as successfully as we have interrupted it. We can plant and nurture many different species of oaks to serve as stewards of the earth and really pay back for some of the damage we've already done. In nature, oaks often take as long as 17 years before they bear their first crop of acorns.
There are vast differences in sizes and shapes and even leaf form. So here are the two major groups, white and black. White oaks have sweet-flavored acorns. Leaves with rounded lobes, and their acorns mature in a single season. They include the white oak, swamp white oak, bur oak, and chestnut oak.
Red oaks have bristly tips to their leaves, and the acorns are noticeably bitter, and they require two seasons for the acorns to mature. These include, of course, the red oak, but also the black oak, scarlet oak, and pin oak, too. Sometimes in the winter, you can see the immature acorns waiting for the next season to ripen.
But all oaks are not enormous. There are smaller varieties and hybrids that will remain manageable in the home landscape, like shrub oak. And there's a town called Shrub Oak, actually, in Westchester County. They can get this to the size of an ordinary maple, for instance. There are several non-native types of oaks, too, like the English oak. But you probably want to plant those native oaks instead of the European ones.
They need room. But they don't have shallow roots that'll buckle sidewalks like some street trees that have outworn their welcome. So there can be some use as a street tree if you use the right varieties.
We're keeping our discussion of the oaks to New York natives, but there are many others you can take a look at that can thrive in some parts of the state. Chinkapin oak is a toughie that tolerates difficult conditions and is a slow grower. It's a shrubby grower and a great food source to wildlife.
And the famous live oak. What is a live oak anyway? First, the bad news. They won't grow here, but no discussion of the amazing oak tree is complete without this southern beauty. The live oak is evergreen, not technically, but for all practical purposes, and can get enormous. Picture the scene in Forrest Gump where the boy runs down the driveway, lined with them, all covered in Spanish moss.
One big part of the reason we're so fond of oaks is our common history. Men have revered the oak since historical beginnings. Since the ancient Greeks, we have admired the sheer size and longevity of the oak. As humans do, we attributed strength and wisdom to the oak from observing its size and longevity. Also, it seems that the oak is reputed to be more likely to be struck by lightning than any other tree. This makes it logical that many European cultures associate the oak with their gods of thunder and consider the oak the tree of life, with its branches representing the heavens and its roots reaching the underworld.
The Native Americans revered the oaks as well, often making oaks the meeting place for important gatherings. and the Druids built their whole religious life around oaks. The very name of Druid is supposedly derived from the Latin and Greek root words Druids and Druze, both meaning oak. The Celts made their magic wands from oak, and the oak represented the 80th anniversary gift.
Humankind have revered the oak since historical beginnings.
Beyond religious and superstitious meanings, oaks frequently have historical impact. In Athens, Georgia, is a tree that owns itself. Its owner was so fond of it that he deeded it autonomy in his will. Its age was unknown, but it fell over in 1942. So now we have the son of the tree that owns itself. The people of Athens planted an acorn from the original and granted it the same status.
The same thing happened in Eufaula, Alabama. In 1936, there was a copycat. The mayor granted a post oak the same status. I'm still puzzled about the property tax status for both trees. Maybe religious exception?
Many of these famous oaks are also called witness trees, with several dating back to the Revolution. The Bedford Oak in Bedford, New York is one. It was officially certified to have been alive at the time of the signing of the Constitution. It's 20 feet in circumference and 69 feet high. It also has a spread of about 100 feet.
There's a War of 1812 survivor. A willow oak in Maryland, witness to the Battle of Bladensburg, just before the British set Washington, D.C. aflame.
Gettysburg is home to a number of witness trees. A swamp white oak is also known as a Sickles oak, after the Confederate general Daniel Sickles. His claim to fame was that he gathered his troops under the oak before he disobeyed orders and led his troop into disaster, not the least of which was losing his own leg to a cannonball. The oak was reputed to be at least 75 years old at that time and has grown into a big, beautiful tree, and we can visit it when we go to the battleground on tours.
Still in the Civil War era, there's a white oak at Manassas National Battlefield Park. It survived both battles of Manassas, a.k.a. Bull Run, and is a big, healthy specimen today. So if you're touring Manassas, Bull Run anytime, you can find this and several other tree survivors of the battles.
From Virginia, heading north to New Jersey, there's a Keeler Oak that witnessed the Colonial and Hessian troops passing by during the Revolutionary War. Well, that's a pretty brief overview with some of our favorite fun facts. For more hands-on tools, the National Audubon Society has a great field guide to North American trees, Eastern Region. And if you're a fan of the Peterson Guides, the field guide to Eastern trees is also excellent.
And Doug Tallamy has a book specifically devoted to oaks called The Nature of Oaks. Pick it up and take a look.
So I'm going to go out and plant an oak.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Stay tuned for Patch to Plate.
My name's Annie Skabinski. I'm a master gardener, volunteer, and a member of the Nature Calls podcast team. In today's episode of Patch to Plate, I'm going to talk about melons. I want to talk about a great tool that Cornell's made freely available to New York gardeners. It's a website that allows us to rate and review vegetable varieties that we've grown. I think of it as Yelp for vegetables. It's called Vegetable Varieties for New York Gardeners, and it's a citizen science program. It allows you to search fruits and vegetables by keyword. In this case, I searched for melons, and then was able to check out the varieties that have scored well with other New York gardeners. To be listed, a variety has to have a minimum rating of 3.5 on a scale of 5. You can limit your search to varieties that have scored, say, 4 or 5 only. It's a cool tool, and in addition to reading others' reviews and ratings, you can leave yours for varieties that you've grown. I put a link in our show notes. Registration takes just a few minutes. When I took a look, the top-rated watermelon variety was the AU Sweet Scarlet Melon. This variety yields a big, round, heavy fruit, like 20-pound watermelon. It's got a dark red fruit and a striped green rind. It is probably picture-perfect for a picnic. Let's walk through a watermelon salad. Get out a big bowl, big enough to handle a cup and a half of fruit per person that you plan to serve. You should also figure on 1 cup of cubed seeded chilled watermelon per person, a handful of chopped arugula, a couple of tablespoons of crumbled feta, and maybe a tablespoon of finely minced red onion per serving. Mix those ingredients all together in your bowl. Now whisk up a quick dressing, even parts balsamic vinegar and extra virgin olive oil. Use roughly a teaspoon and a half of each per person. Combine that with some salt and pepper and pour the dressing over the salad, toss, and serve. With these proportions in mind, it's easy to scale up the recipe for a large crowd. And even half a portion would be a nice starter for a summer supper. If you're removing the rind, you can make watermelon pickle and enjoy that even in the off-season, evoking the memories of summer. I've put a link to a safe canning recipe in the show notes. If you're interested in canning and preserving, give a listen to episode 6, where CCE's own Becky Palmateer provides an introduction. The Cornell veggie site that I mentioned has a wealth of cantaloupe varieties to choose from. I saw 7 varieties with 5 out of 5 stars and another dozen or so with 4-star ratings, all grown successfully by New York gardeners. Most are hybrids, but there are a few heirloom varieties too, with names like Sweet and Early, Goddess, and Sugar Queen. The temptation to add melons to the garden is very real. I need no temptation, however, to eat cantaloupe. It's my favorite among summer's sweet treats. Some folks like their melons sprinkled with a little sugar, others with a dash of salt. Of course, as with watermelon, a squeeze of lemon or lime can perk up the flavor of a melon that seems a bit bland. A ripe slice of chilled cantaloupe would be welcome on my plate, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Beyond chilled, treating melons like cantaloupe or honeydew with heat intensifies the flavor, turning juice to syrup and the natural sugars into caramel. You can give your melon the heat treatment on the grill, under the broiler, or stovetop in a pan. It can also save an underripened fruit from disappointing you by concentrating the flavors. Here's an example. Peel and seed a honeydew or cantaloupe. Cut it into 1-inch slices. Place these on a sheet pan about 4 inches under the broiler until they just start to color. Start checking at 4 minutes. If the barbecue grill is hot, use that instead. Flip them over and broil them for another 2 minutes or so. Sprinkle the pan with a few tablespoons of chopped pine nuts and give it 1/2 minute under the broiler until they just begin to toast. Serve the melon and the pine nuts warm, drizzled with balsamic vinegar and a couple of grinds of black pepper. This taste treat was inspired by a Mark Bittman recipe that I read several years ago, and we're still enjoying it. The recipes that I've talked about today keep melon preparation simple and celebrate these delicious seasonal fruits. I've got one more in the show notes. The crazy preparation involves shallots and anchovies, and I wait every year to get a ripe enough melon to really enjoy it. Go to our website for a link. And for other recipes, please go to the Cornell Nutrition page on our website. Enjoy. That's it for this episode of Patch to Plate. I'm Annie Skibinski.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at columbiagreenmgb@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.